Talk given Saturday, 9th March, 1974. I wonder how many of us, in these days of mounting turmoil and stress, really understand the difference between pleasure and happiness. Happiness is a state of well-being in the religious sense. It is a state of calm, of ease, a state which cannot be striven after. Happiness is not a prize delivered to one in consequence of some achievement. Happiness is constitutive of our human nature, using that word human in the profoundly religious sense. In its true sense, in terms of the actual meaning of that word, as derived from its Sanskrit origin, the happy creator, the prefix hu, H-U, or in Sanskrit you can interchange H and S sometimes, su or hu, means happy. The one who is well. And man means the creator. I'm deliberately using the word creator instead of its first meaning, which you would find in any dictionary. Man is the Sanskrit root from which is derived the verb manyate, meaning to think. But for us, to think is purely... don't take it. For all of us, to think really means nothing other than talking silently, discursive thought. It is not in that sense that root man and manyate is used in the deepest teachings of the Upanishads, for instance. But manyate means really the precipitation into manifestation of primordial creative energy, which is the unknown, the mysterious unknown. No one knows what it is. We may use words like God, Brahman, Godhead, or Allah, Ahramazza, use any term you like. Fundamental energy, if you want to use scientific language, or so-called scientific language. We don't know it. And what's more, we as we are, at our present level of consciousness, at this moment, can never know that. Because at present we are functioning through our senses and our faculty of speech, language, synthesizes all our sense experience, and in synthesizing our sense experience, produces a mental image. Rather, I should say, a whole series of mental images or constructs. And it is these constructs of which we are alive in the ordinary way in our waking state, in our worldly consciousness. That profounder dimension of mind is closed. It's asleep as we are here now. All our consciousness, all that we take in when we talk or see or whatever it is in terms of limitation only. The limitation being the sense images through sight, hearing, etc. So our thinking here is a discursive talking process. Language is the key. The speech faculty is the dominant faculty in us ordinarily. But when that comes to rest, there emerges, after its activation, this profounder dimension for which there is no language. There are no words to express that. And therefore we cannot talk and convey it. We might talk about it and suggest this, that or the other. But whatsoever we say will inevitably be misleading. It is a little bit like this. You can't pack a solid object into a plane surface. Three dimensions cannot be packed into two. And the other mystery, an infinite number of two-dimensional surfaces can never be piled up one on top of the other to make the three-dimensional object. Now you see, this is the great mystery of creation. Put it in another form, that which is in its own absolute reality remains a closed book to me. Now, when I really see this and understand this, there is humility. There is no, and I'm free of the conflict of conceit on the one hand and humility on the other hand. Or pride and humility, if you like. I'm free of all that. Now, the implication of this is that there is a mode of awareness which comes into being in some people. Otherwise, we could never have talked about this at all. There is a mode of awareness which comes into being when all this has quietened down. And one is in complete tune with the mystery of the creative process. We have termed it in India the activity of mind, of pure mind, the all mind, the absolute mind. In the teachings of Hermes Trismegistus, you will find the same sort of presentation. This creative power is called All Father Mind. It's a very interesting coincidence, shall we say, if you like, that civilizations so far apart in those old days, 3,000 years ago, sort of realized the same thing. Now, this creative activity, as we call it, is the meaning of man. This is what theistic theologies have described as the thought in the mind of God. We can only use phrases which refer to ourselves. We can never know God as God. We can only know God by pretending that we know and projecting ourselves into that sphere. I am a two-dimensional flat surface whatever I do, I shall never know the three-dimensional nature of the reality, if I am a two-dimensional flat surface. We really must appreciate this. And then we'll see that the profoundest things of religion are not matters of mere belief, blind belief. And whenever they do become matters of blind belief, we are always misled and we stumble into wrong ways and wrong action. So now, happiness is constitutive of our human nature, the happy creator. This is man's destiny. This is what is emerging out of him. And when the religiousness within him comes to full fruition, he will be free of the illusions associated with creativeness, with that word creativeness. When he is free that way, he is in the happy state. He is at ease. That is why I said that this happiness is not the reward of striving. That belongs to this world, with its ambivalence and its conflicts. In that other state, which transcends the ambivalence, without destroying it, without discounting it or attempting to push it aside, in that state there is the real transcendence, and that is the happy state. I'm using the simple English phrase happy state. Other words have been used through the ages, particularly the word bliss. Sometimes peace, the peace of God which passes understanding. Or you can say the bliss. Take the Upanishadic presentation of Brahman, Sat Chit Ananda, being, awareness or attentiveness, and bliss, Ananda, bliss. Now, until we have begun to wake up to the profounder meanings of these things through our own personal realization, otherwise you never can do it merely by reading or by listening, then we understand that that bliss, that pure happiness, has no relationship to pleasure. Pleasure is something which is sought. Pleasure, unlike happiness, is disturbing. Pleasure is sensational excitement. Pleasure belongs to the non-transcendent awareness, consciousness. It belongs definitely to the realm of discriminative consciousness, in which I am separate from that which I am experiencing or looking at or listening. Belongs to the realm of vijnana, to use the ordinary term in India. Discriminative consciousness. Pleasure belongs to that realm. Now, as long as anything in our life, in our thinking, feeling, speaking, doing, belongs to that realm, we are in the realm of division, of discord. We are in the realm of sin, in the original meaning of the word sin. Whatsoever sunders or tends to sunder or hurt the fundamental unity of the universe. That is the meaning of the word sin. Not merely the common garden moralistic meaning of it. Anything which destroys the unity or hurts that unity is sinful. And the hurting of the unity has its specific meaning in each of the kingdoms of nature. And that meaning is different in each of the kingdoms of nature. The earth undergoes earthquakes, volcanoes there are, produces floods. Now, if I were to produce an earthquake, an explosion, and we know that explosions do occur and have occurred very close to us during the last 5 or 6 years at least. If I do that, I'm doing something sinful. But when the earth does it, there is no sin in it, because it's its natural process. That is the process by which new formations come into being and make life, growth, progress possible for plants, animals, and ourselves. You see, it's so necessary to have the all-embracing width and the all-penetrating depth of vision and understanding. This is our special task as human beings. So now, pleasure belongs to this discriminative realm, and it is associated with the delight we take and the attachment we form for sensational experience, not realizing that that belongs to a subhuman state. As you know, I have insulted the human race times out of number when I have said that we are all subhuman, we are not yet human, truly human. The true human, the Son of Man, is identical with the Son of God. That's the meeting point. That is the fruition point of man. That is the state of nirvana. That is the kingdom of heaven. That is the liberated state. Remember again and again, don't form pictures about it, because it's unpicturable. All my mental constructs will be false constructs. When the thing happens naturally and sweetly, in the divine circumstance, so to say, because you have really flowered out, then suddenly it is there. You can't go about the world searching for the most desirable, the most wonderful, the most beautiful. It suddenly is before you. I would put it like this, that it is always before me, but my eyes are too covered with dust and I am blind. Now this is a fact. This is a real fact of our existence. Whatever the external shape of things, it is the most marvelous, the most wonderful thing in the here, now, this living moment. But I'm unable to perceive it in its wholeness. I'm unable even to begin to glimpse its profound import and significance for me as a learner. And that is why the most wonderful, the most worthwhile, is everlastingly distant from me, although it is nearer to me than hands and feet and breathing, or to use the Islamic phrase, my jugular vein. Let us appreciate this great difference between pleasure and happiness then. Let us then look into the origin of pleasure. How is it that we are pleasure seekers? How is it that we do not just allow ourselves to be happy? First and foremost, quite naturally, the reason is we are ignorant. We do not know any better. We have been conditioned this way from the time we were born. We have experience, bodily or organic experience throughout life. Certain sensations are pleasant. They don't hurt us. Other sensations are hurtful sensations. We like the pleasant and desire to repeat them. We dislike the unpleasant and we want to keep away from them. And because we do not understand the unity of the universe, we take a malicious delight in inflicting unpleasant sensations upon others and complaining very bitterly if unpleasant sensations come to us ourselves. This is how it starts. And our sensations come to us through our senses, the avenues of the sense organs, sight, hearing, etc. And this builds up the whole complex of that which is pleasurable to each one of us. But this is the state of bondage. This is the expensive state, the state in which we squander our life energy. This is the state where we can never bring about a right balance of payments. We are everlastingly in debt to the external world, to the circumstance, the environment, and the pressure, the anxiety, the annoyance, the resentment, everything keeps mounting up and up and up. And we are all so blind that we don't see that one of the fundamental roots of it all is not in the circumstance, not you, not the outside, but right within myself. I am a stupid, miserable pleasure seeker, a slave of pleasure. Then, if perhaps some stimulus wakes me up to this, I run to the opposite extreme and say, out with all pleasure. I repress the senses. Instead of understanding the senses and sense functioning, instead of understanding what are called the natural urges, the desires as they arise up, the situations as they occur, I try to run away from life. I become an escapologist. And I do it, of course, out of the vanity and egoism of the ignorant person in the name of religion and of God. Oh, it's not for my sake. I give up everything for God's sake. But I haven't got a thing to give up myself already. What am I giving up? I'm only being a liability on God, just as there are millions of people who are liabilities on the state and they go to the state for their existence and squander what is given by the state in the next pub. Perhaps this sounds a bit harsh, but you see, a good doctor cannot be squeamish as regards the accuracy of the diagnosis. He has to diagnose absolutely accurately. And there is no question of either mercy or cruelty involved in the truth. The truth includes all. I am a pleasure seeker in the ordinary way, and therefore I am one who makes a mess, makes trouble, makes difficulty, piles it on. I am a producer, to use the Buddha's term, of dukkha. I, as I am here now, this moment, this is what I have to see. And I must not try to run away from life, nor must I try to repress or to hurt myself in any way, because that too is a mistake. Whatsoever hurt is inflicted, whether upon oneself or upon another, produces, because we live in this ambivalent state, an opposite reaction which accumulates in the subconscious, resentment and anger and hate, and biding the day of vengeance. Look at world history. Tribes have always bided the day of vengeance. Nations have done precisely the same. The history of man were better not written. It's an extraordinary thing that the Hindus, through these thousands of years, have been noted for being the only people in the world who never produced history, never wrote history. They just said, this king reigned so many years, his son reigned so many years, his son reigned so many years. If he built a bridge which did some benefit to the people, they may say something about it. And they say a lot about all the holy ones who came to their courts and poured out wisdom. Yes, that they will record. Strange, isn't it? But perhaps subtly very wise. So now, we look for the origin of this pleasure-seeking and this slavery to pleasure in the senses and the operation of the senses. Look briefly at the manner in which the senses operate. I start my life with percepts, don't I? Everything is new, the entire world is new to me. Look at the extraordinary way in which a newborn baby, as soon as it begins to open its eyes and look around a little bit and respond to the external stimuli, look at the way it looks fixedly with wonderment at all kinds of things and people and this and that. It is just looking. It doesn't know what it is seeing. It hasn't learnt language yet. It hasn't begun to talk. It is only passingly aware of a series of sensations which make an impress upon the brain, because this is the actual mechanism of a living body, but there is no sort of structure given to it. Concepts haven't begun to form. Memory is not at work. So it is just a process of accumulating impressions in the immediate now as it flows past, moment by moment. This is how I start. Gradually, the succession of percepts of the same type of event, the same person, the same thing, begin to be known by the infant, because names are given to it, given to all these, by those around. Language is beginning to play its part in synthesizing all the experiences. And at the same time, the qualitative description in terms of pleasant, unpleasant, nice, not nice. To give two very expressive sounds which people make to suggest the agreeable and the disagreeable. So all this begins to grow. And I, the infant, begin to grasp at this, that, and the other. But I did that the moment I was born. Look at the hands of an infant. They are always doing this, aren't they? You ought to know. And what's more, as soon as the infant is able to hold something and you give it something, it puts it into its mouth. It wants to gobble it up. Now, you know, we never get past that stage right through life. We never do. Consider. Look back. Let us look back on our own lives. From the earliest times we can remember, what are we doing? We are all the time doing this with the external world, and we are trying to gobble it up. I like this. I'm going to have it, and I'm going to keep it. Don't want to give out anything. So you see, this is one aspect of the way in which I use, or shall I say, misuse my senses. This possessiveness with respect to all the agreeable sense impressions. A possessiveness, a clinging to them. Now consider another very important factor which comes into play here. As I live, I am being conditioned. No human being can ever escape conditioning. If God Almighty were to suddenly incarnate as a human being, he will get conditioned by his parents, his culture, the particular house in which he lives, the street, whether it's clean or dirty or whatever it is, you see, and so forth and so forth. Everyone inevitably gets conditioned. Now, as a result of this, and as a result of the concepts as they form in my own mind, every sense impression that comes to me is interpreted by my brain in terms of my conditioning. And I suffer from the remarkable delusion that because I have experienced this, that, or the other, or am experiencing this, I know it. How easily we say, I've known John Smith for the last 50 years. I know him inside out. Do I? What do I know? I know my mental construct of John Smith. The image in my mind, my mental construct. This is very important. Even if we repeat this again and again, it can never be repeated too often. We always slip back during the day, like the snail climbing up the slippery pole, slips back. I know my mental construct of John Smith. When I meet him, and I say, "How are you?" And he replies, "I'm fine." Two concepts, lifeless things in themselves, abstracted out of a whole heap of percepts throughout one's life, symbolized in the words, "How are you?" "I'm fine." This is what happens when we meet. But did I really inquire of John Smith, "How are you?" Or like a parrot or like a gramophone, just throw out the words, because they are conventional noises. Of course, you all know about this. And yet, how well do we know it? Do we really know it, know this so well, that we are free from it? That we don't do this? Just make conventional noises. Do I have a real concern for John Smith every time I see him? Oh, I say, I know him so well. He's as strong as a horse. He's quite all right. So, naturally, just courtesy, I say, "How are you?" And he, with equal courtesy, says, "Oh, I'm fine." You see what we are trying to get at? The reality of communication is not there. The pretense at it is there. And when I'm addressing John Smith, whom am I addressing? The living being now whom I'm seeing, or my mental image, my construct, which I have built up over 50 years? I ask you, how impossible it is then for there to be real friendship, real love. How impossible it is for there to be understanding. Because you see, our senses are functioning this way all the time. These very senses, which lie at the root of our greed for pleasure, supposing John Smith is in a bad mood, and I say to myself, "Oh, he's in that awful mood. I better not annoy him or say this, that, or the other. He's rather touchy on that point." So, what's happening? I'm dropping a veil between John Smith and myself. I am sundering the unity of the universe. I'm sinning. And he, relative to me, is the same. And I, relative to myself, am the same. I have a picture of myself. Oh, I'm this sort of fellow. And the picture is a hopeless lie. It's not the truth. Now, perhaps, all this may help us, even a little bit, to understand why the founders of the great religions always started off with advising man to beware of the peril of the senses. This is one of the deep meanings of the peril of the senses. When we look at the whole thing superficially, what happens is that we set up a resistance against the peril. We want to overcome evil, to fight against it, to destroy it, to wipe it out. But what I am trying to do then is trying to destroy or wipe out myself, because I am that evil. That evil is me. It is me, myself, I am seeing, or trying to see. Can't do it that way. And therefore there is no happiness, no happy state. There's a state of conflict, of misery. Sensational delight, yes, maybe. But sensational delight is expensive, isn't it? The morning after the night before. To say nothing of cirrhosis of the liver or whatever else may come about. Now we must really appreciate this and understand it. Understand it. Now what does that imply? Understanding needs, amongst so many things, the ground of a state of harmlessness. A state of harmlessness. What are some of the factors which make us harmful? Our beliefs, our ideas, our convictions, our interests, as we call them, as and when they are opposed to my neighbor's beliefs and ideas and convictions. Then I'll be prepared to hurt my neighbor in defense of my beliefs and ideas and convictions. Won't I? But what is the reality? The living being, my neighbor. My beliefs and convictions are worthless. Mental constructs, rigid structures, my prison houses, which effectively shut me in and prevent me from entering into the freedom of eternity, of the infinite, that which has no constriction, that which is the source of all benediction to human beings. So the peril of the senses gets associated with the peril of the mind and the heart, the desires and the thoughts. And it stems from this pathetic pursuit of pleasure, this getting enraptured with sensational delight. And watch carefully. Remember, Jesus' word was watch. The Buddha's word, the Hindu Buddhist word is be mindful. Watch very carefully the process as it takes place. Now, when one watches in the right way, that means becomes aware of one's reactions to every sense impression, then these beliefs, convictions, these prison houses begin to collapse. Or let me perhaps put it this way. The solid, opaque walls of the prison become transparent, utterly transparent. They are not there anymore. They become transformed. And they give you that psychical energy to go on. The devil is not to be overcome. I have to embrace the devil, take him right to my heart, after having seen him at a distance. I must take him to my heart. As long as I hold him at a distance, I shall be everlastingly plagued with evil, the evil which is me myself. But when I take him in, really take him in, recognizing that that is the me at the moment, or at least part of the me at the moment, then in that state transformation is possible. It is somewhat like the eating of food. You can look at the loveliest dishes in the world on the table, but you'll remain hungry if you just keep looking. You've got to take it into yourself. And then the process of digestion goes on, and there is nourishment and all the rest of it. So too with the devil. I have to take him into myself. This is not a case of mere acceptance as against mere rejection. This is a case of true transcendence. Because in this taking the devil in, one does not therefore spend the rest of one's days in a sour mood of tolerance. Oh, I've got to adjust myself to my shadow. This is one of the grievous mistakes of modern psychology. And it is an equally grievous mistake to think in terms of getting rid of the shadow. It is because the light within is not a light, so to say. The potential light within is not a light. Therefore, I cast a shadow. If I stand in the way of the sun, there is a shadow. Look, my hand is in the way of that lamp, and there is a shadow. But if this hand were itself all light, there is no possibility of shadow. None whatever. It's impossible for the light itself to cast its own shadow. It hasn't got one. Now this is our task. So for this, there has to be understanding. And understanding can never come into being as long as I preserve any division between what I call myself and the other thing. I must always wake up to the fact that the other person, the other thing, is another version of myself. It is an extension of me just as much as I am an extension of it or him. There is a oneness, an actual oneness. If I really see that, I shall never waste time blaming the other fellow. Takes one nowhere, blaming the other fellow. Nor will I waste time praising the other fellow because I like him, or what he does or thinks is agreeable to me. In the complete union, all these ambivalent criteria and standards absolutely vanish. They are non-existent. Now, what is the implication of this? The mind is empty. The shunyata. This emptiness, the no thing, is creative energy, the realm of creative energy itself in its transcendence, in its fullness. And this no thing, by self-limitation, how it does it, I don't know. No one ever has put it down in writing or can put it down. It expresses limited things. The one infinite, universal, no thing expresses itself, presses out of itself, and there are multitudinous things. Now, if you and I begin to see truly and have the eye of wisdom, we shall see that the words you and I are only convenient, conventional sounds for the purposes of the pragmatic purpose of everyday living. But there is no separate you, there is no separate I. In reality, in actual fact. Now this cannot be seen by the eye. It cannot be thought by the brain. But there comes the point when consciousness gives over. Discriminative consciousness, vijnana, gives over to this all-embracing awareness. This awareness is not my awareness or your awareness. It is the one and only chit of the sat-chit ananda of Brahman. It is the state of the sunyata phala samadhi, if you like, in Buddhistic terms. It is the state which some people have talked of as cosmic consciousness and all the rest of it. But all these phrases have terribly misled people, making all sorts of mental constructs about them. But this state supervenes. And when it supervenes, the separation is completely out. It, the totality, is using this tiny, finite particular of that same one totality in order to manifest miraculously that the infinite shows itself through the finite. Then there is the happy state. What we call the mind is in the healthy state. And just as the healthy body is happy, the healthy mind is the happy mind. And it is that healthy mind which is capable of understanding. Don't relate this word understanding to intellectual comprehension. That applies in our realm of differentiation, the sense-discursive thought world. Intellectual comprehension applies to mathematics and algebra and this, that, and the other, and so forth, and art and science and philosophy and everything like that. You have to transcend all that in order to let the religious consciousness come to fruition. You go past intellectual comprehension, and then there is only total awareness, which is not mine, not yours. It is God Almighty, if I may use that conventional phrase, who has come to self-knowledge through you. This is what happens. There is nothing for me, there is nothing for you. Get rid of all those illusions of getting a nice little pension or a 20% rise in your weekly wage in heaven. Nothing of the sort. The rise, if there is a rise which you will get, is infinite percent. So there is no me, there is no you in that infinitude. Now, this understanding, which is the transcending of mere intellectual comprehension, and do forgive me, I take responsibility for deliberately interpreting the word understanding in this way. But I have no other means of trying to convey this sort of deeper thing. This understanding is always a wise compassion. It is a compassionate wisdom. This is what understanding is. Wise compassion, compassionate wisdom. It is not particularized. It is not limited. It has no particular shape or form. It is an influence. Influence, a flowing in of transcendent energy and power to maintain and make, in this mysterious way, even more beautiful that supreme harmony, which is the unity of the universe. This is the happy state, the meaning of happiness. And in this state, you are truly attentive. What happens then to the functioning of the senses? And this is very important, because whether one is the holy one, the perfected one, or whether one is the worst scoundrel on the face of the earth. We all use our senses all the time and have to. When this transformation of my being, of your being, can take place, then when I see John Smith, I am really looking at the live creature as he is now in himself, because no longer is my mind cluttered with mental constructs of him. It is totally open, and the heart is totally open, and that is a state of communion. Therefore, in my act of seeing John Smith, my sense of sight has worked as a cord of communion. And the same applies to all my other senses, hearing, touching, smelling, tasting. Our senses, therefore, are now the cords of communion from moment to moment, right through our life, including our sleep state. You see, what a transformation. And this is the human state.